yesterday, and I hope those of you who didn't come will get a chance to see the film, because it is, of course, an important document, an important representation of the historical moment of the partition that we are beginning this term's readings with. And it's also a way to think about representation beyond the literary, right? So while we are looking at literary representations, there is also a whole array of material, whether it's in the form of memoirs within archives, letters, or material memories, or visual and filmic and photographic representation. And the film, I think, is particularly interesting because, as I said, it was drawn from a short story by Ismat Çugtay, who is was one of the most important, preeminent writers in Urdu, women writers in Urdu. So I'll just say a few things about the film, and I'm hoping that in the seminars we can talk more about it. So the film, you know, I think it's good to see it on the big screen, because you get a sense of not just the film itself, but the materiality of film. You would have noted that the production quality, you know, wasn't the slickest, right? That there was this sense of things having been put together. And I think that that itself says something about the film and what it was about. And that is that Garm Hava, or Scorching Wind, as it's often translated, was part of what was known in the early 70s as art cinema, or parallel cinema, or new wave cinema. So this was an attempt to make films that were that could take up issues that were far more socially challenging than mainstream Bombay cinema could. You know, as you know, mainstream Hollywood, Bollywood, I mean, there are limits to the things they can show, the things that they can subvert, right? Whereas a parallel cinema tried to go beyond, you know, the dominant, the hegemonic frames of looking at the nation and community and so on. Which is not to say that the popular is not important. The popular is very, very significant in shaping culture at large. But this was an attempt to do something different. In fact, the filmmaker M.S. Sathyu was a member of the Indian People's Theatre Association, which was a left-wing communist theatre group which had existed from the 1930s onwards, presenting plays and performances, you know, which were about people's lives, whether it was the peasantry or the working classes or women, the marginalized sections of society. So the filmmaker had been part of that. In fact, all of the actors that you saw in the film were also part of this progressive theater movement. You can see that they're all sort of to different degrees committed to the idea of the new wave or parallel cinema, which is what explains the quality of the film, because what we saw was a copy of a restored film after this film was produced and shown. The quality of the film deteriorated, and it was only in 2014 that a lot of money was raised to restore the film. And you can see that, in the quality of the film. Because there was supposedly no commercial market for a film like this, the film was made on a very, very low budget. And you can see that he took actors from the world of theatre. And it was actually shot on a camera. Okay, this is important because, you know, when we talk about materiality, this is also part of it. A camera which was actually lent to the camera person by the directors, by a friend of the director, because Satyu could not afford recording equipment. The film was shot silent and it was all dubbed later. And again, you can see that in the way in which the dialogues are delivered. And the location, sounds, etc., they were all dubbed post-production. And the costume designer, the script writer, they all interchanged their roles as the film was made. we can see that the film is coming out of this kind of radical tradition of performance and entertainment. And I guess just two or three things I want to very quickly flag before going on to shame is that one can think of the film as a kind of critique of a new India, right? So what you see in the film is an examination of the principles of Indian secularism. Because at the heart of the film is the dilemma, is the ethical, political, emotional dilemma of the central protagonist, Salim, about whether he should leave India and go to Pakistan, right, like others in his neighborhood or even his own family members did, because Pakistan was seen to have been created for Muslims. And yet he remains committed to India right until the very end, committed to the idea of a secular India. And throughout his struggle is that this is his homeland. This is where his home is. Why should he leave? And of course, until the end, you know, when he's almost the last man remaining. The film is set not exactly during the partition, but in its aftermath. There are references to Gandhi's assassination. As some of you would know, India gained independence in August 1947. In January 1948, just a few months after India's independence, Gandhi, who had spearheaded the Indian nationalist movement against colonial rule, was murdered by a Hindu fanatic, by a Hindu fundamentalist. Okay, because the Hindu right, you know, which always had a problematic relationship to nationalism, even now, though they now claim to be the only nationalists in town, they were behind the murder of Gandhi because they saw Gandhi as secular. And they thought that India should be the mirror image of Pakistan and be a homeland for Hindus. Right, that has been one of the long-standing battles for the soul of India, for the heart of India. So the film is set in the aftermath of Gandhi's assassination, and the question asked is, you know, what is the future of India, and what is the future of minorities in India? Right, if it is a secular state, how will minorities exist there? And you see the coming in of a new kind of, you see these lingering suspicions from the partition, right? In this kind of society where, you know, he finds it impossible to get a bank loan, to rent a home, because of course all of those prejudices which the partition had fanned, but also because of the reality that so many Muslims had just fled to Pakistan, okay? And visually, the film, even as the story is about Indian secularism, you can see how visually, too, the film registers a very specific version of Indian secularism as something that is syncretic, as something that is inclusive. And so, for instance, the main song in the film is a Qawwali. A Qawwali is a musical tradition that comes out of the Sufi tradition, and Sufi is of course the less authoritarian, the less orthodox version of Islam, right? It's a more syncretic interpretation of Islam. So the Qawwali, for instance, in India, in South Asia, in Pakistan, is kind of pan-religious. There are lots of Hindus who are, you know, huge devotees of the Qawwali and of Sufi shrines. The camera pans to the Taj Mahal, because the story is set in the city of Agra, where the Taj Mahal is, and other monuments built by Mughal rulers who ruled just before the British came in, and who were pan-Indian and who had philosophies of inclusion and syncretism, all of which of course is under attack in contemporary India. So the film kind of celebrates that culture of inclusivity and of secularism. Just two other quick points. One is the idea of the home, right? What is home and who belongs? Which connects with our discussions last week on the partition stories. And the connection between house, a physical house, home, and nation. Right? You see in the film the grandmother's attachment to the physical house, right? Because that is where she had come as a young bride, and her refusal to leave that physical house, and in the end that is where she must die, she dies. How does a house become a home, right? And what is the relationship between home and nation? And as you see in the film, all of these ideas are connected with questions of law, of legality, property rights on the one hand, because of course the house was in the name of the older brother who goes off to Pakistan. So legally, the house is declared to be the property of someone who no longer lives in India, right? So legally, the Indian government acquires that property. So on the one hand, house, home, and countries are circumscribed by law and property regimes. On the other hand, there's the question of sentiment, of memory, of attachment, of affect, right? And the collision between these two is what you see in the film. Also, the relationship between family and nation, right? That the family gets divided when the nation is divided. And that is played out in interesting ways. And finally, the relationship between gender and nation, right? What happens to, I mean, at the heart of the film is, of course, the young woman whose future is a very limited, a very circumscribed one. She's grown up, you know, in this Muslim household, and the horizons extend to her finding a good husband and getting married, right? But again, how the partition shatters, you know, her hopes and her desires, right? And leaves her in a situation, and the film, of course, narrates her end. So again, as I said, I hope we can talk more about it in the lectures. But for now, let's move on to a novel that actually allows us to make the segue from partition stories to the rest of the texts that we will be studying, you know, this term. Now, Shame, which was published in 1983, is Salman Rushdie's third novel. The first was Grimus, which very few people read, only those who are committed Rushdie fans. The second, of course, is what propelled him onto the global stage as one of the most prominent writers, Midnight's Children, which was published in 1981. And Shame, which came hot on the heels of Midnight's Children. This novel is set in the last years of colonial rule and in the immediate years after independence came to the subcontinent. And in this novel too, of course, there are characters who experience partition, right? Wilkes, for instance, you know, and her family who experienced displacement during the partition. And so there's a certain kind of historical specificity to when the novel is set, the dying years of colonial rule and the beginning years of independence in the subcontinent. But where is the story set is, of course, a question that Rushdie problematizes and that I think is at the very heart of the question of representation in the novel, which is the question of where is the novel set, right? As we learn in the novel, the country in this story is not Pakistan, or not quite. There are two countries, real and fictional, occupying the same space, or almost the same space. My story, my fictional country exists, like myself, at a slight angle to reality. I have found this off-centering to be necessary, but its value is, of course, open to debate. My view is that I'm not writing only about Pakistan. Okay, so there's a kind of play here, right? A kind of narratorial play here that, of course, by drawing the reader's attention to the fact that this is not really about Pakistan, Rushdie is saying, this is about Pakistan, right? But also what is interesting is that the way in which the narratorial voice, you know, his story, I mean, it actually says my story, my fictional country, the way in which nation and the national subject, their destinies are linked or put together. Of course, Rushdie did that most explicitly in Midnight's Children, in which Salim Sinai, who's the protagonist in Midnight's Children, is born at the very hour of, at midnight, the very hour in which India and Pakistan gained independence, right? So he talks, the phrase used in Midnight's Children is handcuffed to history, right? That the protagonist, like most of us, that there's a sense in which the subject is handcuffed to history. But we also see Rushdie's sense of distance. So it is Pakistan, it is not Pakistan, right? It is this, but it is not at the same time, this. It carries on in this vein, I think, in the sense of positioning the authorial perspective both inside and outside, right? Both inside the nation, you know, as someone who is from there and who is privy to the corruptions, right? The malign culture that pervades the ruling classes of Pakistan, but also as an outsider, right? Someone who is looking in. And it is the sense of duality, you know, that pervades the narration of shame. But it also helps him look at the ideology of nations and nationalism very critically. And of course, you know, that is the ground on which the partition happened, right? Because people were willing to kill for the idea, you know, of the nation. So he goes on to use terms like Pakistan as the product of a moth-eaten partition. Okay, and I'm thinking here of Faiz Ahmad Faiz, his sort of phrase, mottled dawn, right? So the idea of a moth-eaten partition, right? That, if you look at the map as well, you know, in the aftermath of partition, right? So West Pakistan and East Pakistan are supposed to be one country, right? But separated by this vast mass of land, which is India. So this idea of it being fragmented, it being torn apart. Insect-nibbled slices of the old country that became Pakistan, right? These nibbled slices on the west and east of India. And goes on to say that this was a country so improbable that it could almost exist, right? So again, playing with improbability and existence, right? You would think that something that is not probable cannot exist, right? But he says it was so improbable that it could exist. That is something that Rushdie has repeatedly talked about when, you know, he's often seen as a writer in the tradition of magical realism, you know, particularly that of the Latin American tradition of Gabriel Marquez and Lorca and so on. But Rushdie has always sort of made this interesting point that he says that reality in South Asia, right, because of its layers of different histories, is actually so crazy that it's crazier than magic, right? So what Western readers may think of as fantastical or magical or improbable is actually the reality of life in South Asia, right? And in fact, I found this fantastic interview. It's a British Library recording, if you're interested in this novel and in Salman Rushdie, where Tariq Ali is in conversation with Salman Rushdie soon after Shame came out. And Rushdie says that Shame is an extreme understatement about Pakistan, right? That in fact, in reality, things are far more grotesque, you know, than he is able to present in the novel. Now, of course, this is enhanced by not just the doubt he creates in the minds of the readers about whether this is a national allegory, right? Is it about Pakistan? Is it not about Pakistan? That is further enhanced by the fact that his protagonist, right, is this peripheral man, is a very unlikely hero, right, who he calls the peripheral man, who's Omar Khayyam. Right, he takes the name of the famous poet, who's born in a deathbed, living at the edge of the world, a peripheral man. He writes about him on page 19 as dizzy, peripheral, inverted, infatuated, insomniac, stargazing, fat. What manner of hero is this, right? So not the kind of protagonist one would expect. He's in fact a spectator. He's not somebody who participates directly in the events, as it were. He's a voyeur. He lives life vicariously, right? And in certain parts in the novel, he also, you know, becomes a kind of foil to the narrator, right, as the protagonist. He's also an autodidact and a prodigy. And of course, he has very messed up gender politics, which is what then the novel goes on to look at. But it is through this sense of improbability, both about the location, but also through the narrator, and the figure of the immigrant and the muhajir. Muhajir is a word used in Pakistan for immigrants from India. And that too raises questions about the status of the narrative, the truth value of the narrative. Because of course, there's a narrator who's telling us the story. Again, in interviews, Rushdie has talked about how attracted he is to oral stories, to oral histories, oral narratives, And he's tried to use some of that, you know, in the novel. In fact, there's some hilarious passages, you know, where I remember there's this character spewing abuse, you know, and it's just, you just have to burst out laughing because it, there's a sense of the auditory, right, of people, you know, of stories being told, of words being spoken. But also, again, this kind of outsiderliness, this kind of peripherality of the point of view of the narrator. So we don't know very clearly whether it is Rushdie who is telling the story, because at some points he comes into the novel, right? And he talks about his own biography. You know, he talks about returning to Pakistan or being upset, you know, when his father sold off the property in India and him bringing his young son to meet his parents in Karachi. Sometimes the narrator is completely fictional, right? It is not Rushdie. So the question of are they interchangeable? Right? Rushdie is very much the outsider who periodically comes to Pakistan, which is what has been one of the charges against Rushdie and against a lot of elite writers. I guess one could make this charge against all elite writers, right? That do they write from this perspective of the outside, which is this kind of privileged perspective, right? They assume a sense of privilege that, you know, they can look into societies in ways that those living inside them cannot see. You know, and I think that to me is a very interesting literary and political problem posed by this novel, right? Does Rushdie slash the narrator see things about Pakistani society that Pakistanis themselves cannot see, right? Are they funny to themselves, or are, you know, are we getting this through Rushdie's critical sensibilities? Again, this idea of being both inside and outside. In fact, people have often asked that how he has these amazing insights, you know, without actually having lived in Pakistan for long extended periods. And he's talked about the fact that his family always lived there and he has visited it for long stretches of period, of different periods. So along with this question of whether this is about Pakistan or not about Pakistan, whether the narrator is an insider or an outsider, the main plot of the story also makes us question the truth value or why do we even have to care about truth in fiction, right? And if we do care about truth in fiction, you know, we're surely not looking at truth in an empirical sense, because in an empirical sense, perhaps this is not true. The novel is not true about Pakistan. But in a ethical, ontological, other ways, perhaps it is true about Pakistan, right? So what you get in the novel is a very, very potent, direct, sharp dissection of a society that is feudal and corrupt to the core. Now, obviously, he is referring to the Pakistani elites, right? I mean, the main characters in the story are these elites. They're army generals, they are landholders, they are business families, right? So it's not that he's critiquing all Pakistanis. This is a portrait of a particular class of people, right? I think, you know, just as one could do a particular portrait of a class of landed elites in Britain, the Tories, the Eton-going Oxford, you know, university, you know, educated elites. Those elites are there in all societies, right? So this is a searing critique of this fraction of society that is corrupt, that is feudal. And here, of course, the two characters, the two political characters, Raza Haider, is, you know, based on the real life politician and leader Ziaul Haq, who was an army dictator in Pakistan, who declared martial law in 1977 and suspended all democratic institutions and apparatuses, and in fact inaugurated the Islamicization of Pakistan. So under Zia, basically, he moved power to the military and to the religious establishments, to the madrasas, to the mullahs, right? He got the constitution and laws changed, got them made into religious laws, introduced Sharia law, right? That was his political program. And the turmoil in subsequent years, we can see is very, it's, you know, can be traced back. Of course, it can be traced back to the time of independence, but definitely to Ziaul Haq's regime. And the figure of Reza Haider, you know, is very clearly based on Ziaul Haq. The figure of Iskandar Harappa is based on Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, or not based. But these are the two characters Rushdie has admitted that, you know, they are very much his portrait of those political figures, though of course he uses his writerly imagination. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto had been the president of Pakistan, then the prime minister of Pakistan. Ziaul Haq got him arrested and ultimately executed in 1979. He had been democratically elected, and you may have heard of his daughter Benazir Bhutto, who was Pakistan's first woman prime minister. So it's a kind of searing critique of this society, this complex of the military establishment, the religious establishment, you know, and of course the few families. It used to be said about Pakistan that there were about 15 families that owned all of Pakistan, right? And again, what seemed shocking then, I don't know how many of you saw the latest Oxfam figures, which says that they're the 26th richest people in the world own 50% of the wealth, right, of the world. So what is being, you know, portrayed here has exponentially expanded, of course, as we can see. And in the story of the three sisters in captivity with which the novel opens in colonial Quetta, and this is still the time of British rule, and he calls it the land of Q. And again, is it Quetta, which is on the borders with Afghanistan, or is it Q, his an imaginary place, who are impregnated at the same time by a white colonial, right? And so critics have often seen this allegorically, right? The corruption, you know, inseminated by colonial rule. And through them, you know, the portrait of a dying, bankrupted aristocracy, right? The house where they live, it is this precisely the, a kind of a decaying realm. And along with that decay, along with the feudalism and the corruption, of course, is the question of shame and the question of censorship and the question of repression. So this is also a portrait of a deeply repressed society, right? Where shame is used ideologically to censor people, to repress desires, to make people, you know, not talk about, you know, the country, the politics, and what is going on, and so on. So this, I think, leads to the question then of whether we can read the novel as an allegory, right? What is the form of the novel? On pages 1771 in my text, the narrator declares that this is not a realist novel, right? And again, this is a kind of a narrative device that he says the opposite of perhaps what he means, right? So this would lead the reader to think, actually, this is then a realist novel, right? You know, the protestation is a bit too much. But there are elements of the allegorical, of the fantastical, of the magic realist, and of playing with the conventions of realism. I've already talked about how he uses peripheral figures, peripheral histories, the fact that the story opens in Quetta, not in Karachi, not in Lahore, not in Islamabad, which are the main cities of Pakistan, but in Quetta, you know, on the frontiers of Pakistan. So already a space that is on the margins. But also the use of fragments, you know, that we don't get a linear story. We get the story through fragments. But I think that there's a kind of tension there between this kind of postmodern, magical, realist form, but at the same time that it has a certain kind of universality, right? That it has a pattern, which I think produces an unevenness of form that connects, that or that ironically comments on the social conditions of post-colonial Pakistan. In other words, what I'm suggesting is that the form, which is so uneven and so unstable and unreliable, on the one hand, on the other hand, it's actually very dexterously structured. You know, you can actually map the whole novel. It's very intricate and, of course, innovative at the same time. But the unevenness that we experience as readers, with the narrator coming in, with the author coming in, with all of the different characters speaking in different kinds of languages, which are then transcribed in English, that can be read as an ironic comment on the social conditions of Pakistan, right? That how do you represent Pakistan, you know? You can see some of this in fact, in the opening passage, which reads, "In the remote border town of Kew, which when seen from the air resembles nothing so much as an ill-proportioned dumbbell, there once lived three lovely and loving sisters." Okay, and there's almost this kind of a fable-like quality. But also, I don't know how much you've read of modern British fiction, but to me, it's also very reminiscent of Forster. If you read a Forster's A Passage to India or Rudyard Kipling's Kim, this kind of description of a town, a remote border town, their names, but their real names were never used, like the best household china, which was locked away after the night of their joint tragedy in a cupboard whose location was eventually forgotten, so that the great 1,000-piece service from the Gardner Potteries in Tsarist Russia became a family myth in whose factuality they almost ceased to believe. The three sisters, I should state without further delay, bore the family name of Shakil and were universally known in descending order of age as Chunni, Munni, and Bunni." Right? So there's some interesting things going on in this passage, apart from those echoes, you know, of Forster and Kim and of Kipling that I noted, but also this kind of fairy tale quality, once upon a time in a remote town, right? But then these are soon undercut by the narratorial interventions, the asides and the editorializing, right? So again, even the form of the fable is not a stable one in the novel. That there's a make-believe town, Q, which turns out to be not so make-believe after all. For it is, and it is not, Quetta, which is of course a border town and indeed resembles, when seen from the air, nothing so much as an ill-proportioned dumbbell. So he's actually, again, sort of playing with these different levels of the probable and the improbable. And of course, what is interesting here, I don't know if you picked up on this, but the reference to the Gardner Potteries in Tsarist Russia, right? So on the one hand, very fable-like and being told by the narrator. On the other hand, fairly intricately researched, historically researched, Because if you did a search, then you would find out that an English banker called Francis Gardner had opened a porcelain manufacturing factory in Verbiliki in Moscow province in 1766, receiving the patronage of the Empress Catherine the Great and making a number of exquisite and very large service sets of over 1,000 pieces. You know, I did this research and I found this. And I thought it was so fascinating because, of course, it's a piece of colonial history, right? But it's also, it signifies this kind of global, and a global elite class, right? So these were, you know, elites of Quetta, but you can see their connection, you know, with having, they possess a piece of Tsarist Russia, right? Where a well-known English manufacturer of porcelain had set up factories, right? So again, this kind of colonial, post-colonial circulation, you know, of material artifacts as well are, you know, presented here, okay? Now, even the once upon a time is not allowed to rest. You know, it's not, you know, again, the temporality of the novel is also brought into question. For it is not long in the first chapter that we are informed, quote, all this happened in the 14th century. I'm using the Hegirian calendar, which is the Islamic calendar, naturally. Don't imagine that stories of this type always take place long, long ago. Time cannot be homogenized as easily as milk. And in those parts, until quite recently, the 1300s were still in full swing. Right? And of course, this is his jibe at the kind of encrusted backwardness, you know, of this dying aristocracy. Right, so he's playing on the fact that, of course, in the Islamic calendar, it is the 14th century, you know, as opposed to the Gregorian calendar. But he's playing on that, right? But for this class of people, it is as if the 1300s were still in full swing, right? They're so out of touch with time that, you know, they have become a kind of a weight on the nation. Through all this, we see, of course, the narrator emerging as magician, as a kind of manipulator of time and narration, right? But he's also this translated man. He's a man who's been born across. He is also, like Omar Khayyam, a peripheral man, okay? So let's move on then to a few words about the thematic of shame in the novel. Okay, there's a very intriguing quotation from page 59 which says that this is a novel about Sufia Zenobia, or perhaps it would be more accurate, if also more opaque, to say that Sufia Zenobia is about this novel, right? So what does this mean? We can spend actually a lot of time trying to unravel this, trying to figure out what he means, you know, by this. Now, about in the second sense, I don't think is referring to subject matter, but to what we might describe as an atmosphere, as a kind of poison in the air that we live and breathe in because it is all around us and inescapable. As in, shame rings this novel about, or shame is all about, or all around this novel, right? So to begin with, you know, this quote I think suggests that there is a kind of ubiquity of shame, right? It surrounds the novel, it's the air that the novel breathes. But of course, you are told that there are hundreds of different nuances of the word shame or sharam as in Urdu. And here are some quotes. Wherever I turn, there is something of which to be ashamed. Again, this idea of ubiquity. Shame, dear reader, is not the exclusive property of the East. So before we think that he thinks that this is, you know, the only society which needs or which experiences shame. Wherever I turn, there is something of which to be ashamed. This is the longer quote. But shame is like everything else. Live with it for long enough and it becomes part of the furniture. In Defense, which is this posh locality where his family lives, you can find shame in every house, burning in an ashtray, hanging framed upon a wall, covering a bed. But nobody notices it anymore and everyone is civilized. Right? So the relationship between shame and civilization, right, and the fact that it is so ubiquitous, it is almost invisible, right? And then finally, these are just a selection of the quotations on shame. What's the opposite of shame? What's left when sharam is subtracted? That's obvious, shamelessness. Right? So the whole novel, in a sense, is built around this dialectic of shame and shamelessness and the relationship between the two. Now, in one respect, the novel is obviously a savage critique or a denunciation of the fraud or the horror or the scandal or the shame that is Pakistan, an impossible country, as we learn in the novel, unstable at the core, insufficiently imagined is one of the phrases for all of the reasons that we looked at last week as well. But shame in its encyclopedias of nuance, that's the phrase from the novel, encyclopedias of nuance, is of course much more than this, right? And he talks about how even sharam is a wholly inadequate translation, a short word but one containing encyclopedias of nuance. It was not only shame that his mothers forbade Omar Khayyam to feel, but also embarrassment, discomfiture, decency, modesty, shyness, the sense of having an ordained place in the world, and other dialects of emotion for which English has no counterparts. Okay? So this is really interesting. I want to spend just a few seconds on this. Right? So this is a novel written in English. Okay, and this is what I said in my introductory lecture as well, that even when we are looking at texts written in English, right, there's this kind of very complex traffic with local languages, with regional languages. Okay? And so this consummate writer in English, Salman Rushdie, when he's talking about shame, he almost throws up his hands. He's trying to define it in all these different ways, but he's saying, actually, English has no equivalent to this complex of nuances around shame and sharam. Actually, I cannot translate it. This cannot be translated. Okay. But what we can get from the fact that it cannot be translated is that it is a sign. Even if we cannot get the linguistic nuances of what sharam, izzat, honor, shame actually mean in South Asia, what we can read it is as a sign of a repressive society, right? And the relationship between shame and violence. As it says on page 85, there are things that cannot be said. There are things that cannot be permitted to be true. Right? So when this whole idea that this is a society in which, you know, truth is very carefully monitored, right? And not just, you know, from the political powers, right? But within families, but also it is internalized. You know, that scene when Sophia has just been born, and Raza is, you know, horrified that it's not a boy, right? And we are told that the baby blushed, right? So the internalization of shame, you know, shame as a kind of bodily, you know, affect. And of course, how closely it is linked to the question of gender, to the question of sexual repression. The fact that her being born a girl, right, born female, becomes the source of shame. So shame in the end, I think one could say that is this kind of this unsettling trope that disturbs the inside and the outside, the political and the personal, male and female, formal civility and barbarism, right? So formally, the more formal and civilized and polite Raza is, the more we know he's hiding huge depths of barbarism and of violence that he's capable of, right? So I'm going to stop there, and there are lots and lots of passages to discuss, I think, on this question of shame, which I hope we will do in the seminars. Okay, so see you all there.